Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, August the 3rd, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thank you all for joining us this evening. We have two special guests this evening, but first, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard. How's it going?
Hey there, David. Everything's going pretty well here in, here in Florida with the COVID-19. Anyway, tonight we have two special guests, Lauren Price, Holly Farrell, of the National Veterans Advocacy Group called Veteran Warriors, to discuss some important issues of great interest to veterans and their families. First, though, I want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, your comments, and questions, so you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Now back over to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. Let me introduce our special guests this evening. Lauren Price is the founder of Veteran Warriors, a national veterans advocacy group, and she has led that organization since its creation in 2009. She has testified before Congress on veteran issues. She served in the United States Navy for a decade between January 2005 and January 2015, including serving for more than a year in Iraq as a convoy driver as well as a public affairs officer in Baghdad. She co-founded the veterans group called Veteran Warriors with her husband, Jim Price, who is a retired Navy senior chief. Lauren's been our guest many times on our show for the last several years, and she's with us again tonight along with Holly Farrell, who is the National Appeals Director for Veteran Warriors. Holly oversees all veteran caregiver-related matters, and in that role, Holly handles cases of those who've had their applications denied, who have been in the program but discharged, who are attempting to resolve issues with the VA, and veterans and their caregivers who are attempting to resolve whether to apply at all and whether they meet eligibility requirements. It's a complicated program. Holly handles those issues as well as issues involving veterans who require assistance in actually applying for the program and those looking for other resources and or possibly that the veteran requires more care or other related matters. With her clinical background, the majority of Holly Farrell's time is spent assisting veterans whose caregiver program applications have been denied by the VA and those that have been discharged from the program. She does that by helping them draft proper and effective appeals. So let's welcome Lauren Price and Holly Farrell to the Veterans News Hour to discuss these important issues. How are things going, Lauren and Holly?
Excellent. As always, living the dream.
Great. How are you, Holly?
New rules out, and so we're nice and busy now.
Very good.
We stay busy. We can't complain about that.
Well, that's good. We appreciate all you're doing for veterans. I know you both have a great deal of expertise on these issues, so what I'll do first is offer some questions, and then perhaps Lauren can help by steering the question to who would be best to answer, either Lauren or Holly. So let's get started. I know the VA is in the process of changing the Family Caregiver Assistance Program. Before getting into the details of the program, because it's very complicated, could you first explain, you know, the big picture? What's the purpose of that program?
Congress's initial intent for the program was to try to keep seriously wounded veterans out of nursing homes and assisted living facilities. That there is plenty of civilian evidence that the patient being able to recuperate or to continue to reside in their own home and be cared for by family and or close friends is beneficial to recovery, rehabilitation, if possible, or at least to maintain stability, both physically and emotionally, for the patient. And Congress finally figured that out with the help, of course, of our our peers in the VSO community, and they passed the law that the post 9/11 era veterans who had serious injuries that required assistance with one or more activities of daily living, such as getting dressed or feeding yourself or preparing your own food, taking medication or managing your medication and appointments and such, that this would allow a caregiver, which is the formal term is the caregiver, it doesn't necessarily have to be a family member, allows that person to stay in the home and provides a monetary stipend in different tier levels, tier three being the highest, one being the lowest, and in qualifying cases, they also are eligible for health insurance through CHAMP VA so that that caregiver can stay in the home and provide care for that veteran. With Mission Act being passed, there were three sections of Mission Act, sections 161, 162, and 163, that affected changes on the program. The changes were nominal with the exception of opening the program to eligibility to pre-9/11 veterans on a schedule. Vietnam era being the first group that will be eligible to be let into the program. One of the other caveats was that the computer system that the caregiver program utilized from day one was called the Caregiver Application Tracking System. It was a standalone program that did not copy over to medical records and that only those people who worked in the program had access to it. The other medical providers, psychiatric professionals, no one else had any access to the program. Congress made sure that one of the caveats was that this program was going to get scrapped and they were going to have to certify a new system that would copy to medical records and be accessible to all the providers treating a veteran. Somehow VA got this, their wires crossed that they believe they have as long as they need to create this system, and that the inclusion of prior eras, prior to 9/11, that it was contingent upon this. That's not true. The law is very clear. They were supposed to have it certified by October 1 of 2018. They still do not have it certified, and they're still withholding taking applications for any prior 9/11, pre-9/11s to the program. So that's, they've also said that because Mission Act created rules that needed to be changed, that they had to go into this rulemaking process, which is the crux of what we're going to discuss, and they put together a laundry list of rules that they believe needed to be changed or changed criteria in the program, and they're grossly misinformed when, in fact, that nothing in Mission Act gave them that permission or that authority. And Holly can discuss it better, more in depth as to what they did and what's going to happen if they're allowed to go through with this.
Okay, well, that's a great background, Lauren. I appreciate that. So let's go to Holly. Holly, if you could tell us about really what you've seen on kind of the front lines as the National Appeals Director for Veteran Warriors, and what you've seen happen and perhaps what you think should be happening.
Well, what we've seen happening is we've seen a large number of veterans being discharged or their applications being denied from the program, and they've been wrongfully denied or wrongfully discharged. We have several cases, current cases actually, that they meet qualification, whether it be tier qualification or whether it be basic eligibility, but yet they've been denied or their tier increase was denied, what have you. So we go up the chain, and for whatever reason, the VISN tends to always agree with the facility level. One of the major things we see that will come from these rule changes is that the majority of participants currently in the program right now will no longer be in the program as they will not qualify. And that doesn't fully include Tier 1, but that includes Tier 3 as well. And a lot of people don't understand that.
So what does that translate as far as what a disabled veteran who may be living at home and relying on either a relative or a non-relative caregiver, what does that look like in a typical case? as far as someone that, you know, what their disabilities might be like under the current system in which they've been eligible for a caregiver, and then now they're going to lose that. Can you kind of give us an example?
Yeah, so under the current rules, not the new rules that take effect October 1st, current rules, you can have extensive or relatively minor injuries, but it must be an injury, whether that be including mental health injuries such as PTSD. TBI is a physical injury, but many consider that mental because it impacts you mentally. It can include generalized anxiety and depression. They're also included in the definition for injury. Things that are not included are things such as MS, ALS, diabetes, things of that nature. So you must have a qualifying injury right now. So a lot of veterans with mental health injuries, especially related to PTSD, they require prompting and cueing and reminders, especially for their such as their bathing, grooming, and dressing. Many veterans who solely have PTSD or anxiety or depression, you know, those mental health-related injuries, they need those constant reminders. They need the self-regulation. They need to be prompted to bathe, or they see no reason to. They will remain in their regular clothes and not change for days and what have you.
Right.
All of those veterans will no longer qualify.
Wow.
Yeah, it's drastic. Regarding the physical injury, right now you have to have at least one ADL for physical injury to qualify.
And what's an ADL that, for our listeners? What does ADL mean?
The ADLs are the activities of daily living. The ADLs for this program are feeding, which is literally the act of getting food from your plate to your mouth, chewing and swallowing. It does not include meal preparation or reminders to eat. Dressing, bathing, grooming, feeding, dressing, bathing, grooming. Mobility, which is your ability to not only walk, but you have to be able to walk on a variety of surfaces without assistance. It also includes you getting up and sitting down from a chair to bed, transferring and such. Assistance with prosthetics. A common misconception is that prosthetics is an artificial limb, and that's not what the law states. The law states any prosthetic or orthopedic appliance, which can include your cane. It can include knee braces or what have you, anything that the veteran has that is an aid or something that's required that is not something that a typical person can put on that's disabled, such as if you have a lace-up back brace, it's difficult for anybody to lace up their own back brace, so that is not one that would be considered. But a standardized back brace that Velcros in the front, that would be considered. So those are your ADLs, and then you have the supervision and protection, which people with, well, I should say veterans, with physical injuries also require assistance with the supervision and protection as well as those with mental health do. They can also require reminders for medication. Some veterans require their medication to be locked up so they have no access to the medication due to various reasons. Maybe they forget they took the medicine and take an extra dose unintentionally or what have you. A lot of them still require redirection. They require assistance for safety matters, such as if they're a fall risk. Some veterans do not have feeling in their hands, and that means they can't determine whether the water temperature is right.
Wow.
We have one veteran who actually turned on a stove, forgot the stove was on, and put their hand on the stove eye and burnt the palm of their hand. But they didn't know their hand was burning because they don't have any feeling in their hand.
Wow.
So those are your ADLs and your supervision and protection right now.
So what's the difference between the current and the new program as far as those ADLs?
The biggest difference is that, well, you still need at least one ADL or daily assistance with supervision and protection. The current program does not require daily assistance with supervision or protection, and the current program does not require hands-on assistance in person with at least one ADL every day. For instance, you could require someone to call, give you a call or set you a reminder to bathe. You don't have to be there in person. Well, that will no longer exist under new regulation. You will require in-person assistance or you do not qualify.
I see.
The other part to that is that those with physical injury, they must require hands-on assistance in person with at least one ADL every time that ADL is completed. The veterans who require assistance, for instance, first thing in the morning, getting dressed, or getting out of bed, but once they start moving throughout the day, they're able to, you know, get themselves in and out of their chair, put themselves to bed at night. They may be able to bend a little more and be able to dress or undress themselves at bedtime. Those veterans will no longer require care. Well, under this new rule, and vice versa, some veterans require no assistance in the morning, but as the day goes on, they require assistance. That will no longer count. So if you don't require assistance with the ADL every single time that ADL is completed, you will not qualify under the new program for the physical ADL.
Wow. And do you think that was the intention of Congress in passing the statute, or do you think it wasn't Congress's intent, but the VA has just gone farther on its own?
No, we actually know it was not Congress's intent to restrict the program this much. In the Federal Register, you can find comments from the House on their prior attempted rule changes in 2017, and you can find comments from the Senate Committee on Veteran Affairs in the new proposed comment period from March 2020. Both the House Committee and the Senate Committee on Veteran Affairs have clearly stated in their letter to VA that it is not their intent to restrict the program, but rather to expand the program, and they do not agree with these limitations.
I see. Now, I understand that your organization, Veteran Warriors, early this year teamed up with another group, the National Veterans Legal Services Program, and offered comments to the VA about what were at that time the VA's proposed changes. What can you share with us about that, as well as kind of segue in into your positions about these new, quote, final regulations, which were just released this past week by the VA?
Lauren, would you like to take that?
Yeah, we, working with NVLSB, they're a law firm, and most of their work is they do pro bono cases, helping veterans with predominantly case related to their benefits, meaning from the compensation side, or DIC, which is the what's commonly known as the widow's benefit, things like that. Over the last couple of years, we've worked with them delving into this program with various things. As Holly noted, in 2017, VA tried some rule changes. They tried again in 18, and both times were shot down quite loudly by Congress. This time, when they put this out, they put out a preliminary notice in December, and what we saw after we actually went and had a meeting in January, we discovered just the magnitude of what they were going to attempt to do, up to and including rewriting the law, which is changing the eligibility criteria, changing the stipend calculations, and where the methodology for paying the stipends comes from. All of these things are actually drafted in the original caregiver program law, and they were not edited, modified, or amended under the Mission Act. So we worked for months, actually, with NVLSP, who great staff, love working with them, to culminate a set of very articulate arguments to prove to anyone that would read them that VA's off base. They don't have the legal authority to do this. They are literally changing the law, and nowhere in Mission are they granted that authority. Our goal then was obviously hoping that wiser heads would prevail and VA would take a second look at, because we weren't the only ones putting comments in. There were over 200 commenters. Instead of doing that, and as Holly noted earlier, the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs even filed comments this time, essentially in chorus with ours. VA chose to just go ahead and move forward with almost verbatim what they had issued earlier this year as their proposed rules. And we've already, in the first 24 hours since they issued that, we have received probably close to two dozen calls or points of contact asking us if we found or heard that that VA has been, they were granted a bypass on this, that they were going to be allowed to bypass Congress and not get the law amended, that they could just do this anyway. And
who
all
was
of
granting
us are sitting
this
here going,
bypass?
No, that isn't how this works.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Who was so-called granting this bypass to the VA? Did they just took it
right.
upon themselves?
Such a thing doesn't exist. There are specific
right.
passages in Mission that allow VA to make rules for specific things. And I'm actually paraphrasing one of the responses we received from one of the people we work with at NVLSC is they've stepped so far over the line, even on those, they don't have, there's three caveats that are less than 200 words total in Mission Act that relate to this program. There's nothing else in Mission, despite its monumental size and the magnitude of it, that grants them authority to ignore Congress and change law. And that is our position, and it's one we're going to continue to work forward now because we have about 60 days before it goes live.
It's supposed to go live or go into effect October 1st. Is that right? These new,
yes.
These new, okay. Now, I know there's a couple kind of areas I'd like to ask you all about. One is to dive into the details about your analysis of the changes and important information. I know your organization has put out, you know, a one-page summary that has 20 different issues or changes that you've noted. But before getting to that, let me just ask you about what you were just getting into, which is these final regulations, which were released last week, but they're supposed to go into effect October 1st, and it looks like the VA has just, run outside the boundary lines that Congress has set for it. If you wish to share with us, if you can, I understand what the game plan ought to be or will be in holding the VA accountable to that, either your organization or the National Veterans Legal Services Program or other organizations?
Well, to begin with, we hope to. We held a strategy meeting amongst our team and went over some of our plans and hope fors and our wishes. One of those that we plan to make very public is that we are going to be reaching out to all of our colleagues across the enterprise, across the entire community, and all the VSOs. We work with a lot of them pretty frequently because we're also, as you guys know, we're also on a task force regarding toxic exposures.
Right.
And we're on there with these same people. So we're going to be reaching out to them this week and asking them to, I'm sure every one of them has already either started or is finished now reviewing these rules, and most of them also commented already on the proposed rules in concert with what we were saying, too. We're going to ask them to stand with us and get the VA to the table, that they need to pull this back and postpone any enactment of these, because it's not, there's no law saying they have to do this by October 1, and asking them to absolutely postpone anything until we have some legal minds looking at this and not just VA caregiver support program staff and leadership. Because we know that the proposed rules were written not by an attorney, but they were written by one of the more senior people in the caregiver support program. That's not good. Not when you're talking about things that will affect laws and benefits and stipends and things. You can't have employees doing that are not attorneys. especially if there's the potential for it to be challenged in court.
I see. So that's so there will be, it sounds like, if I understand you correctly, that there's going to be a big team effort among a lot of veteran service organizations try to bring the VA to the table. If that fails, the potential for litigation sounds like it might be another avenue. Let's dive into, is that right, Lauren?
It's an avenue. We're not looking into that at this point because that is not the way none of us, and I think I do speak for the rest of our community, you know, all of our partners out there, that we don't want to go to court. None of us do. We want to have a collaborative effort that we all sit down and we make sure that this goes forward the way it should be, the way that Congress intended it when it drafted the original law and when it drafted the changes in mission. And I'm very confident that our partners are going to be willing to work with us on this because from just the scuttlebutt we're hearing, we already know that they're all, the ones we work with typically are all doing, feeling the same way we are. They're like, what the heck is going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like just an incredibly complicated program, even within the VA world, you know, all the different rules and then the changing criteria. Let's talk about some of the 20 different items that your organization has put out in a talking paper, you know, and sort of compare that. The VA's press release from this past Friday touted the fact that these regs, new regulations, including the expansion of the caregiver program to veterans of earlier eras, which will occur in two phases. The first phase, which will, and I'm adding the word allegedly here, but the press release says that it will begin October 2020 and will include eligible veterans who incurred or aggravated a serious injury in line of duty on or before May 7th of 75, which is, as you say, the Vietnam era. And then phase two, to go into effect 2 years later and include eligible veterans of all eras. What can you share with us as far as, you know, any relevant rebuttal or just observations about that, about the expansion?
When we look at the law that they, well, what they're considering their law, their final rule that they have put out, it very clearly states, and I quote, "The first phase of expansion will include eligible veterans who have a serious injury, including traumatic brain injury, psychological trauma, and or other naval or air service on or before May 7, 1975, and will begin on the date the Secretary submits a certification to Congress that VA has fully implemented a required IT system that fully supports the PCAFC and allows for data assessment and comprehensive monitoring for the program." Nowhere in this paragraph does it state that it's going to open to pre-Vietnam and Vietnam-era veterans on October 2020, anywhere, contrary to what VA's assertion is. And that is one of our main concerns, is these veterans have been waiting so long and they keep getting drug out. They were promised October 1st, 2019. They were promised June 2020. Now they're being promised October 2020, but when you actually read what the rule states, there's no indication anywhere for October 2020.
And that's because, Holly, if I understand what you're saying, is that this information technology system, this IT system, which is supposed to be certified by the VA to Congress, is being ready, isn't ready, and furthermore, there's no anticipated date of it being ready. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. They actually state in this rule that the IT system has not yet been certified to Congress, and Congress mandates that this expansion occur in two phases, with the first phase being that the IT Vietnam era and before are put into the program once the IT system has been certified.
I see. So basically, veterans need to be forewarned that this October 1st date is just a mirage, basically. It's not a real fixed date. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is, and it's one we're highly concerned about because Vietnam era really do need this program. They need that assistance.
Well, I know
we
so many
of them. We are concerned about them also getting their hopes up and thinking, okay, we will finally be able to apply within the next 60 days and we'll be eligible, and they will not be because the program will not expand if the IT system is not certified.
And then after that, the rule is supposed to be that phase two, which would be for all the remaining veterans, would be in effect 2 years after that, right? So
correct.
those other veterans, which would include like veterans of the first Gulf War, I presume, and just other veterans from the era from 75 up until 9/11, they're all going to be further in limbo. Okay.
Yes, and well, that's also a concern.
Yeah, so thanks for clarifying that. Now, if you could share with us, because I know your talking paper covers some of these things, and this might help our listeners understand what the benefits are to the caregivers. You know, the idea is to keep these disabled veterans out of nursing homes, assisted living facilities, let them stay in their home, but then they need someone, a caregiver, a relative, or someone else taking care of them. But then there's some sort of a stipend for these caregivers. What can you tell us about that?
Well, let's backtrack a bit. See, if you qualify for skilled level care, that's one of the caveats that you do not qualify for this program. You cannot qualify for skilled level care and qualify for caregiver support. Caregiver support is intended for those veterans who do not require skilled care. It explicitly states in there care that can be provided by a non-medical professional.
I see.
So that's going to be another big issue, especially for the older generation, because a lot of them do require nursing home level care. This is not a replacement for nursing home as far as VA or Congress is concerned.
Okay, well, thanks for clarifying that. So what would be the idea then, or what would be the coverage of the caregivers and the stipends that they would receive, and maybe you can compare it to the current program as well as this new system, which is supposed to go into effect October 1st.
There is a lot of concern over the stipend. We had a meeting with the caregiver this afternoon. Actually, we had two meetings today with caregivers concerned about the stipend. With the stipend being moved to a GS-4 Step 1, it gives the interpretation of employment as a VA employee, but that is not the case. Also, with VA providing insurance, being CHAMP VA, to eligible caregivers, any caregiver who does not already have medical insurance and is on this program qualifies for CHAMP VA. So that is kind of the basis of employment. You're granted, you know, a GS pay rate and insurance, but they have a valid point. So right now, there is a common misconception that there's going to be a GS4 Step 1 pay band across the nation, such as the way that VBA benefit ratings are for veterans. They're the same across the nation. That is not accurate. This new stipend will be solely based on your geographic location or the veteran's zip code, however you wish to state that. Right now, there are three tiers for the stipend: Tier 1, 2, and 3. Tier 3 is for the highest level of support, which means that you are essentially doing at least 40 hours of work. Typically, you're pretty much around the clock helping your veteran if you are Tier 3. Tier 1 is for 10 hours or less a week. That's typically the ones who require prompting and very minimal assistance. And then you have from the 10 to 40, which they count as 25 hours a week, is Tier 2. Right now, those are three different amounts, and they are based on BLS rates. The new tier system, some caregivers will increase, but a lot will decrease, especially considering that they are going with only two tiers. You'll be high tier, which is 100% of the GS Step 4 based on your locality. No, sorry, GS 4 Step 1 based on your locality. And the lower tier will be 62.5% of that same pay rate. That 62.5% is pretty much equivalent to a Tier 2 stipend right now across the nation. The concern is those who will be reduced will be the Tier 3s. If they qualify, they will likely be in the low tier. Through our data, we do not anticipate very many at all will be in the high tier.
I see. Okay, so but we're so that's a major change though between the current and this new system, and it's basically to the detriment, if I can sort of generalize. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's basically going to be to the financial detriment of most of the caregivers. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. And actually, give a prime example. San Francisco veterans, they will lose, if they go down from the Tier 3 to the low tier, they will lose just at or slightly above $3,000 a month in their stipend. Going from their current Tier 3 rate to the GS4 Step 1, high tier of 100%, they're still losing about $2,000. I think it's $2,200 is what I calculated they will be losing. So this is substantial.
Okay. So what do you see as then the likely impact on veterans and their caregivers when this happens? I know it's a tough question to answer.
If we're being completely honest, one of our biggest concerns is where we currently have 22 veterans a day, we're expecting that to be a caregiver rate as well at this point. There will be a lot of, yes, suicide rate.
Okay.
Yes. Because a lot of caregivers take on the responsibility of the family and managing the bills and whatnot, and they're the ones who know, okay, we can't make ends meet now. When you take such a substantial amount, $3,000 and $2,000, that's a lot. But even taking just $200 from a caregiver's budget, that can go into making it to where they cannot put food on the table. Maybe they have to choose between getting diapers and buying food. Those shouldn't be things that you have to determine. It's that, you know, they will lose houses. When this first initial wave began back in 2015, 2014, and 2016, we saw that a lot of these caregivers lost their homes. Their cars were repossessed.
Wow.
It was downright awful. And we are going to see, right now we calculate they have 17 months to prepare financially, and that's what we're telling our caregivers. You have 17 months at your current rate. You need to prepare financially to lose your stipend and be able to live without that stipend.
There's something very important that needs to be said alongside of this doom and gloom. VA and some of its stakeholders have repeatedly crammed down everybody's throat that, well, if it's going to cripple them to lose this stipend, then they need financial management classes. They actually tried to cram that into this as well, to force families to go into financial management classes, because they must be doing something wrong if you strip off, let's just say as an average, of $30,000 a year out of their income. Let's just take that away from them and tell them it's their fault that they can't manage their money.
Right.
Because they also will tell everybody that this is not a permanent program. It's only temporary. You should not be relying on this money. And I've got documents stacked a foot high from VA that say this. You should not be relying on this money. I want to throw this back at them and say, why shouldn't they be relying on this? These caregivers, especially at the Tier 2, Tier 3 levels, they are taking care of the veteran. The veteran can't work. The caregiver, unless they have King Solomon on their side, they can't split themselves in half and go to work and manage a household and take care of the veteran, in some cases, far in excess of 40 hours a week. They expect, these are people, we've sat in the room with these people. These are people who are, I won't say they're in the one percenters, but they are definitely upper middle class or exceedingly upper middle class. These are not people that lived on enlisted pay, and that when their soldier got hurt, they ended up living on E5 retirement, or 100% permanent total with a spouse, never mind children, is $3,200 a month. I challenge them to live on that and not get nervous when someone says, you're going to lose this money, this additional $30,000 a year that Congress says you're entitled to. But now we're going to shame them and say that it's their fault that they can't manage their money. I have counseled with veterans who were kicked out of this program and lost their homes, lost their vehicles. Veterans who've lost that scaffolding of that sense of security, knowing that their caregiver is there and they don't have to, it's going to be tighter. And responsible adults will tighten the belt so that they can live within their means. But taking it away from them and telling them, oh, sorry, if you can't adapt to that, that's your fault, and you need to go back and learn how to manage your money.
Right.
It's not just disingenuous, it's downright insulting. And instead of telling these caregivers, look, we're going to all sit down at the table, and we're all going to look at this, and we're going to work this out, what's best for the veteran and the caregiver, not what's best for VA.
Right.
And one of the key things to drive home is, the new budget that's going into place on October 1, when those new rules are supposed to go into effect, is going to be $1 billion a year for a program that currently has less than 20,000 veterans in it and less than 600 employees. Even if every single one of them was Tier 3, you're looking at $100 million a year in total cost to run that program right now. I want to know where the rest of the money is and where they claim it's going to go, because they haven't hired more staff. And if you go by these rules, they won't be bringing in more people.
Well, do you think the VA is then taking that unspent money that they're keeping because they're kicking people off the program and just diverting it to other either Veteran Health Administration programs or just other programs within the VA?
Well, most of us, we all know that if there's money left in a budget line item, you know, come September 1, it's a long-standing rule. Use it or lose it.
Yeah.
And there's been countless stories out there that investigative reporters have done and found, you know, $5,000 stand-up desks and artwork and new carpeting and new desks and all kinds of new things that are all purchased in the last 60 days of the fiscal year. Because by then, they know how much money they've spent out of the program or out of any line item. Any line item that's left under a VHA budget goes into that facility, into that general fund. So as an example, I know Rick and Dave, you guys are in Tampa. At James A. Haley and Bay Pines, the program, when it's at the end of the year, like it is, we're approaching that right now, any money that's left in there goes back into the hospital's operating budget.
So they have every incentive to kick people off the program, basically.
There's a lot more incentive to kick people off than to put people in.
Right.
Because the first 4 years of the program, it was grossly over budget. Disgustingly so, because the former director was asked during the markup period of the original bill how many people she thought would be eligible for the program. And apparently, and I have no problem saying this, she couldn't access the records that are online publicly of how many post-9/11 veterans are in their system and getting health care from them. Because it would have taken a five-second check through their computers to know how many veterans would have been conceivably eligible. Instead, she told them 4,000. So they agreed. After CBO went through and graded the bill and said, oh, if only 4,000 veterans, it's not going to cost us very much. We can go ahead and do this. And when we were pushing into numbers in excess of 17, 18, 20,000, 30,000 applications, they choked and very systematically started cutting people from the program. And then, as you guys know, we got a lot of publicity about it and moratoriums happened. And we're still under one right this minute. It's going to be that moratorium is going to be 2 years old in December.
Wow.
They haven't fixed anything, and they won't communicate with anyone. But we're still under a moratorium, and now they just want to make it even more restrictive and take the authority away from Congress to change the law.
Wow.
And all because They got this big fat check coming in October 1.
Wow.
I want them to sit at the table and explain how they think forcing families to make deeper cuts, to make more sacrifices, how that is going to be beneficial when VAs already getting more money, because their budget for the healthcare side of the VA goes in a year in advance. So a year ago, they got this money approved. So why are we not fixing this? And I'm sorry, I'm cynical. There's only one logical conclusion for me.
Well, what can listeners, what would you recommend that listeners do to support veteran warriors and also to learn more? Where can they go to learn more about this issue?
First and foremost, they can go to our website. Our web team does amazing work on keeping stuff updated. It's veteran-warriors.org, and they can go through the links and they can get to our caregiver page and they can find the resources. We're asking everyone, even if you're not a caregiver or a veteran, if you're just a concerned taxpayer, this is an election year. Make them listen to you. Call or write or email your member of U.S. Congress or the Senate, House or the Senate. We prefer you email them and follow up with a phone call and say, hey, did you know this happened? Do you know what's going on? And then introduce us. Introduce our organization. Holly and I spend a lot of time talking to members of Congress and their staff. We're more than happy to educate those that are not involved with this and don't know what's going on, because the more legislators that stand up and tell VA they're not going to tolerate this, that VA doesn't have this authority, the faster this is going to get put to bed.
And especially
with nearly 500 members
of
Congress, we could get, all we need is 10 people from each state.
Well, I think that's great advice, and I hope our listeners will follow up on that. And I would assume that focusing, in addition to an individual's own member of the House of Representatives and two U.S. senators, but also the members of the two committees, the House Veterans Committee and the Senate Veterans Committee, I would think that those folks really need to hear from people, right?
Absolutely. Chairman Takano has been a stalwart supporter of us making sure that this program is operated correctly and as prescribed by Congress. He's tried to hold their feet to the fire several times, and I know for a fact if you reach out to Chairman Takano's office, they are going to be receptive and listen, because they don't like this any more than we do. And I know definitely the Senate side, they just filed comments about this. They need to hear from their constituents that we do not want this to happen. And I would love it if just taxpayers would call them. Because you know what? When the veteran community gets injured, we stick together. But the American taxpayer is getting injured too. We're coughing out $1 billion a year for this program. And less than 20,000 people are in the program. And the lion's share of them, we have the numbers available if anyone wants them, the bulk of them are at the Tier 1, the lowest level, which is a couple of $100 a month. It's not the $3,000 a month. So there's a huge bucket of money sitting there that disappears every year, and nobody's asking where it's going. And Joe Public and Jane Public need to be questioning this.
Right.
Because the more they question it, the more spotlight's going to be on what's happening with this, so that we can make this program run the way. We don't want the program to go away.
Right.
We just want it run as prescribed.
Right. Well, that's great insight. I've got a couple quick questions, but before I do, let me make sure Rick Hurley has a chance. Rick, you have any comments, observations, questions for Lauren?
No, you're all doing a great job. It's been very interesting listening. I'll get it back to you, David. You've got
a couple of questions. We just have a few minutes left. And Lauren, you mentioned something which I know you've discussed in our previous shows, and that's the toxic exposure. I follow, your organization's website and your Facebook page. I know there's been some developments, I think, of a positive nature. Maybe you could just, I know we're mostly here to talk about the caregiver program. Anything you want to share briefly about the toxic exposure issue?
Well, you know, but your listeners may not, there is a large coalition that stood up about 2 years ago. We're called TEAM, and that stands for Toxic Exposures in the American Military, because we aren't just focused on burn pit exposures or Agent Orange or radiation or depleted uranium. Frankly, the Department of Defense is the world's most prolific polluter, and its primary and most voluminous number of victims are the military service members. And we got together because it is over, I think we're up to like 35 different organizations now.
Wow.
You know, small ones like Veteran Warriors, big ones like DAV. Everybody's in this because we all have a stake in this. All of our membership and our followers and our supporters, our families, our friends, all of us at some point are you know, dealing with this. We have been pushing. We created a VA bill, and unfortunately, between COVID and, you know, some gridlock in Washington, not much happened. So our VA bill is sitting right now waiting. Senator Tillis just put in our VA bill. It will survive this Congress, and we've got, I want to say five or seven things into the National Defense Authorization Act in this year's budget discussion. We managed to get these in, and these are movements forward. These are things like making sure it now becomes a law that all service members are going to get pre- and post-deployment physicals. It's not just a suggestion anymore or a regulation. There's some specialized things for specific toxics or toxins, but for the most part, what we're doing is we're really trying to push forward on the whole purpose of making people aware is we're sick and we're getting sicker, and VA and DOD have spent 70 years saying the following sentence: we find no causal link.
Right.
And it's the sentence that will make my hair stand up on end and make me grind my teeth, because my grandchildren who are in elementary school know that if you smell garbage burning, to get away from it, because there's bad stuff coming out of that. That's why it smells bad.
Right.
It doesn't take a brain surgeon. It doesn't take a highly educated with an advanced degree to know that burning trash or burying toxic waste is going to hurt people. And
it's
come full circle finally. The whole, you know, the Agent Orange guys paved the way for us. They really did. They suffered in silence, and then they got louder about it. But we are now at a point where we've got John Stewart and John Seal from Feel Good Foundation are championing these efforts with us. And we got some things into the NDAA this year. And Senator Tillis put our bill in, and we think we found a couple of co-sponsors that are going to be jumping on board with that as well.
Well, that's good. Lauren, I hate to interrupt, but we're about running out of time here, and I wanted to thank you so much for touching on the toxic issue. That's something that our listeners can go again to your website, veteranwarriors.org, and also your Facebook page, and we'll continue discussing these, and hope you'll come back on our show again sometime soon at your convenience. But we're about out of time, so I'd like to thank Lauren Price and Holly Farrell for all the great work you are doing for veterans, and thank you for being on our show tonight. Again, I'd like to invite you back anytime in the future that your schedules permit. Keep us updated. Any final thoughts before we have to go?
Just reach out to us, and then reach out to your members of Congress. It's veteran-warriors.org, and any one of my team will be happy to field your calls. We business calls during the day, but emails, send them in. We'll reach out to your members of Congress and help educate them as well. We're here to help.
Thanks so much, Lauren and Holly. Thanks so much for being on our show, and hope you have a great week.
Thanks, David and Rick. We really appreciate you having us on.
Thank you. Well, Rick, we're out of time. We'll have to pass on.
It was a great show there, David. Good job.
We don't have time for our coaching to care.
We'll do that next week. We'll get it in next week. All right. Everyone, have a good week.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Please tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, hope you have a great week. Stay healthy.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.